Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Women's History. My name is Hannah Smith, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Sarah Fox about her book, Giving Birth in 18th Century England. Sarah is a postdoctoral research fellow in the Department of History at the University of Birmingham in the UK. Sarah, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for inviting me, Hannah.
So just to get us started, can you tell us a bit about the premise of this project?
Certainly. So the book is basically an attempt to access women's experiences of giving birth in 18th century England. And it started from this really basic question, what is it like? What was it like to give birth? And I'd done some work on it in my master's studies at the University of Leeds. And I noticed that most of the information about birthing was taken from medical books. So books written by man midwives, accoucheurs, and doctors looking to kind of set out the way in which to handle birth, a medical way of handling birth. And it struck me that there were very few women's voices there, that we didn't hear much from the women and the men, the fathers that were involved in this process. So I wanted to try and recover some of those experiences. So the basic premise of the book is to explore birth and birthing from the perspective initially of the woman that's giving birth, but then that moves outwards and it includes the baby's father, includes the woman's parents, grandparents of the child, the community and the neighborhood that surround them.
How did you become interested in this topic?
It started off as an interest in ritual. So I really enjoyed, when I was doing my undergraduate studies and my master's studies, I really enjoyed thinking about rituals, but not the kind of big, spectacular rituals, the sort of smaller, everyday ones. And then I started to think about childbirth as a kind of everyday thing, a normal ritual that still held this huge significance. And then halfway through my master's, I did my master's studies part-time because I was also working. I happened to give birth myself, which changed my perspectives a lot, actually. So my master's thesis, whilst it sets out some of the basic ideas that eventually end up in the book, it's from a really different perspective. And having my own child and experiencing that whole process just kind of shifted the way that I was approaching the primary documents. So I had previously relied a lot on these amazing books written by these men about how to handle a birth. But I started to want to know the other side. And, you know, these women, you feel a connection. And I'm currently working on something at the moment about connection with historical figures, because childbirth is this really, I think, unusual event, because it's kind of such a key physical event, people feel a great connection to it. Now, it's something that I try to explore a bit in the book, and I wonder how successful I am, is that gulf in difference between how we experience childbirth and how these women that I write about in the book experience childbirth, and how the kind of society and culture shaped those feelings. So you have this strong tie with an event, a powerful physical embodied event that you feel you should know, but then when you start to unpick it, you know, it's so strongly shaped by culture and by society that you can't possibly know exactly how it felt. And that's, I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your discussion of feeling throughout the book. And that's definitely something I want to make sure we get into in this interview. But first, I was wondering if you could tell us what archives you used in your research and how the availability or unavailability of different kinds of material affected the research you were able to do.
That's a great question. So I often joke actually about working on archives that are mainly in the north of England, because I had friends at the same time that were working on archives in Barbados. And there was me in Manchester, an hour away from home, working through the archives. So the scope of the book is very much focused on the north of England. And that's because I live there. And as I've just said, I have or had at the time small children. And that restricts the distance that you can travel. So my archives were more or less all within an hour's drive of my home. So I could get there and back in a day. I think that made the project better, actually, because in England, obstetric expertise was focused in London and in Edinburgh. So in London, you had all the hospitals, the lying-in hospitals, and you also had some training facilities for men midwives in particular. And in Edinburgh, the university offered a degree that included man midwifery from, I can't remember, I think it's the middle of the century. So those were these kind of centres of obstetric innovation, new ways to handle childbirth, but I didn't really want to find out about that. So this sort of self-imposed restriction on to the north of England, I think, really helped me to think and to see non-exceptional experiences of childbirth. And that's how I word it in the book. And I had a lot of difficulty actually coming up with that term, because whilst no experience of birth is normal, right? Normal is not a good word to use, but often it's the exceptional experiences that make it into the literature. So you would get, you know, in this medical literature, you would get discussions of unusual presentations, difficult deliveries. And I wanted to access the more everyday, whilst also acknowledging that no birth is everyday. Each one is special and different for the people at the centre of it. Because it's ultimately miraculous, isn't it? So that move away, that focus on regional archives, I think, was really helpful. In terms of finding the material, it was an accident, really. So I was very lucky to have a conversation with Adrian Wilson, who I'm sure you're familiar with, when I was an undergraduate at Leeds. And I talked to him and said, you know, he expressed an interest in the subject. And he said a comment that, I mean, I'm absolutely confident he won't remember, but he made a comment along the lines of, well, you know, there's been a lot written about it, most of it by him. And, you know, you'll have to find maybe some letters that we don't know about, a cache of letters, perhaps, that will add to the knowledge. And I went off and looked at some letters, and I realised that actually experiences of birthing were often buried in normal letters, everyday letters, so that these experiences are sort of tied up in complaints that somebody's not been to visit them, or the price of wool in Manchester that week. And then you'll see a little line saying, you know, my wife was delivered of a son. And so these, you know, that started again, that switch to different ways of looking at it. So picking through lots of different types of document, I used a huge range of different primary sources to put together the arguments in the book, because I was kind of picking through for these little incidental comments that once you started to look at them revealed a huge amount of information.
So as you alluded to, central to your book is this idea that birthing is a process that goes beyond labor and delivery. Could you tell listeners a little bit about how this worked?
Yeah, so in the 18th century, you see the rise of this, what I would call quite a modern understanding of birthing, which is very much focused on the point of delivery, because that's the transformational moment, the baby arrives. And, you know, a mother is born as well as an infant. And so much of the medical literature focuses on delivery, because that's a kind of controllable moment. That's something that you can observe. And I realized that in the sources that I was looking at, delivery hardly gets mentioned. So I haven't found a detailed description fiction of a delivery written by anybody other than a medical man. It's not to say there isn't one out there, but it generally got glossed over. But what I did notice is that the men and women whose letters I was reading, they talked about the other parts of birthing. So they would talk about the labour and how long it took and whether it was painful. They would talk a lot about the lying in, which is the 4-week period after birth, where a woman was expected to rest, and there'd be lots of people in the house sitting and kind of undertaking the chores for her. So I realised that those were the points that people really focused on. And then when I started to kind of look at the umbrella terms for birthing, so you have women referring to confinement as a kind of catch-all for everything, a lying in as this catch-all for the whole process of giving birth, from the moment that pregnancy ends and labouring starts, right through to the time that they resume their normal household duties. And that kind of caused a shift in perspective. For these women, giving birth was this whole period that lasted several weeks. And that really opened up the scope of things to look at. So the book has a chapter on food and drink and how an infant's birth will be celebrated. And that was fascinating. And there's lots of traditions connected to food and drink that just hadn't been really explored, because they fall outside that delivery moment, that kind of central point of drama in the birthing chamber. But once you move beyond that, there's this wealth of information that sheds light on the networks that women were operating within, and the kind of social tensions and the cultural draws that were shaping childbirth and the birthing chamber at this time.
How did births promote community building? Is there anything that surprised you about this piece of your research? I noticed this come up as a theme throughout the book.
Yeah, that theme really emerged as the research was ongoing. So it was a very organic process. But I began to realise that I started to think about identity and community and neighbourhood and what pulled that neighbourhood of women together. So you have these women that are close by when a birth is imminent. And you start to think about, well, are they there deliberately? Are they waiting for the birth? Who's watching? Who's paying attention? Who's there? Who gets invited in? And once you start seeing these questions or asking these questions, you start to see that there's these kind of threads of community and network, the birthing chamber at the centre of them. And the birthing chamber pulls in local women, and it does it in a sort of centric circle effect. You have the birthing family at the very center, and there's a chapter in the book on this is the birthing woman and sometimes her husband, who stays very close, not in the birthing chamber but nearby, her mother, sometimes their mother-in-law, sometimes her sister, and then maybe a couple of friends, and they're in this kind of central group that get to be there when the baby is born. But then you have these visiting women that live nearby, and they might hear the cries of the infant, which suggests that they're really close if they hear the cries of the mother and the cries of the infant while she's giving birth. And then you have this next circle of neighbours that will visit over the first week or two of the lying in after the birth. And then you have this even broader community then that might attend the child's christening or the mother's churching, or that will see the infant when it goes out for the first time. So I started to kind of see the birthing chamber at the very centre of these networks. And then, of course, as soon as you start to think about community, you start to think about inclusion and exclusion and who is allowed in, who is seen as being part of the community. And the other fascinating thing is that I realised was that these communities that I was thinking about, these groups of women, were really transient. So these birth provided a kind of snapshot of the community at that moment. Now, I can't always see that snapshot, but it wasn't for me. It was for these women. They could see who was near, who was part of the community, who wasn't, who was involved. And it started for the women in the birthing chamber, birth mapped out these connections and neighbourly networks in a really kind of precise way for that moment, because they were always changing as people came and went, people died in childbirth. You know, these networks were always shifting and changing. And so through that, I kind of realised that the birthing chamber was this important social space, really, over the course of the 6 weeks or so that a woman was giving birth under the definition that I set at the beginning of the book. It was really important for the way that people kind of interacted and socialised at this period in time, when your neighbours were really important, because they were often, you relied on your neighbours for survival a lot of the time.
as you've mentioned a little bit, your book is divided into five chapters in addition to the introduction and conclusion. Each chapter focuses on a different theme around birth. You have the body, the household, food, family, and the community. How did you arrive at these categories, and why did you divide the book up in this way?
Well, again, this was quite organic, and actually it changed. This book was based on my PhD thesis, and I divided it up slightly differently in the PhD thesis, and I think this way works a lot better. And this was mainly because they were this kind of separated slightly by source type. So each chapter sort of focuses on a different type of source, not exclusively. So women's letters run throughout the book, and that's really kind of where I get a lot of the information from. But then each chapter is supplemented by different types of primary source. So the chapter on the body is supplemented by the kind of medical writings of the day. The chapter on food is supplemented by recipe books, manuscript recipe books, and the kind of contents, the way that they were set out and the types of recipes that were included in them. So that kind of helped to crystallize the structure. But then also it was about trying to find these key themes and make sure that I could build a coherent argument around them. So obviously the body is a really important part of birthing, and it's one that's remarkably absent from a lot of the medical books. So you often have a description of a birth that doesn't really mention the body very much, which is incredible when you think about it. But of course, it's kind of taken as read that you have this body that's performing this amazing thing. And so I started to think a little bit about hormones. I really tied myself up in a knot trying to think that particular problem through, but how the body shapes birthing, but then also how birthing shapes the body. And that was a really kind of thorny problem that I had to think my way through. So, you know, it was also about identifying these key themes that each one was an important part of this birth process that I kind of introduced at the very beginning of the book. And I think it sort of helped. I was hoping that the book could be read, that it would speak to different types of historians too. So historians of the body, historians of the family, historians of emotion. And these were all the kind of areas that I was interested in as well. So it sort of made sense to try and create chapters that spoke to these particular historiographies in different ways.
So as you've mentioned, the line in practice was very important and is central to this book. Could you explain for our listeners a bit about what line in was and how it was different for women of different social classes?
Certainly. So the lying in period lasted roughly 4 weeks. And I say roughly 4 weeks because it does appear to have changed slightly depending on how strong and how emotionally well the birthing woman was. So it kind of went in stages that were very much dictated by the woman's body and her emotional state. So it would immediately after you gave birth, you would be expected to rest in bed. You wouldn't be expected to take on any domestic tasks. You simply cared for the child. You would try to feed the child because breastfeeding, certainly in the days following the delivery, was important. So rest and recovery was a really crucial part of the lying in period. And then as you felt more recovered, as you felt stronger, you would sit up in the bed and then you would move around the room, and you have all these interesting different boundaries. So you might move around your bed chamber when you felt strong enough, and then coming downstairs in your house is a bit of a moment. So the moment that you go downstairs to take tea instead of having tea brought up to you is an important one. And the final kind of rough stage is when you leave the house, and that's after you've been what's called churched, which was where women went to the parish church with the infant and were cleansed of their sins, and were recognised sort of by the parish community as having given birth and having completed that process. That was an important moment. And what's really interesting is that this process is roughly followed by women of all social classes. So one of the things that I thought was remarkable when I was researching the book was that whilst obviously there's these huge material differences for women of different social status, the kind of overall framework is recognisable. So you have the lying in period was important, as important for a poor woman as it was for a rich woman. The Viscountess Irwin, she had her 4 weeks of rest and recovery, in the same way that Sarah Harold, who was a Manchester woman and her husband was a bookseller, and they had, you know, different material experiences, very different, but similar kind of processes of rest and recovery and recuperation. One of the big differences, though, is the room in which women would recover, the lying in room, which was, you know, was the birthing chamber, and women remained in that room. If you were wealthy and you had lots of domestic space, it might be a kind of suite of rooms with the infant nearby and the nurse. If you were moderately well off, you would have your own chamber and you would stay there. But if you were poorer, you had to be a little bit more creative in the way that you use space during this whole period. So you have women using the bed curtains to create a kind of secluded domestic space after the birth. So the entire room will be used during the birth, but then for this lying in period, you might draw the curtains around the bed to create a kind of space within a space where someone could rest and recover. And a really important part of the lying in period was being visited by all sorts of people. So absolutely friends and family members would come to celebrate the birth, but also potentially people you didn't like, neighbours, people that were important in the community. It was the done thing to kind of call in and see the infant. And one of the really fascinating things that I found was looking at some infanticide court records where the mother had been accused of killing the infant. And there's one particular case where there's lots of testimonies from women that visited, and they recognised the infant because it had a mark by its nose. And they're saying, you know, I remember because I cradled it and I, you know, made some linens and wrapped the infant. And that gives a really fabulous insight into what was going on when people visited. So they were there, yes, to take tea and to maybe eat some cake. I talk a lot about what's called a groaning cake, which was a celebratory cake that you would make before you gave birth and then distribute to all the people that visited you while you were there. So there was absolutely celebrations, and sometimes I think that probably involved a little tipple or a cup of tea. But it also involved helping in the household, looking after the children, cuddling the infant, talking to the other people that were there. So it was a really important arena for the exchange of information, social information about what was going on. So these spaces were really busy. Lying in, whilst it was a period of rest and recuperation, it was also quite busy and quite lively, more lively than I think you would assume initially when you start to think of it as a period of rest and recovery. And I would also add that it wasn't just physical recovery. So emotional recovery was important too. The lying in period was designed to sort of restore the woman so that she could regain her status. So her status in the household, she could take back control of the household and the children, but she could also kind of go back to that social status that she'd enjoyed before. So it was important that she was emotionally well as physically well.
So I was somewhat surprised and intrigued by the prominent place of infanticide in this project about birthing. Could you explain why it's necessary to understand something about 18th century infanticide in order to understand birthing in this period?
So, as I think we've discussed already, sources for this type of project are fragmentary. So you're always sort of, or I was always, picking through different types of documents to try and find out information about birth. And this was exacerbated because I was trying to find out about this kind of everyday experience, this non-exceptional experience. And infanticide cases absolutely are exceptional experiences of birth, but they contain a huge amount of incidental information about what was expected, because an infanticide case was basically something that wasn't expected. It went against all the normal rules. And so by reading against the grain in those cases, it's possible to see huge amounts of information. So for example, in one case, we have a young woman who is pregnant to her employer. And you have the testimonies of lots of other young women saying that they'd sat with her and they'd talked about it and they'd put their hands on her belly and they'd made kind of conversation about whether or not she was pregnant. And this is really interesting because these women are young, you know, they're barely more than girls, and yet they are confidently pronouncing on matters of pregnancy and birth. And they're doing that to the parish constables as well. And this isn't particularly unusual. Nobody is shocked, which suggests that young women did have an idea of pregnancy and birth. Even though we might think it was something that was kind of kept quiet in this period, it can't have been. And this information, you know, this knowledge must have been acquired in a few different ways. I suspect it was acquired in birthing chambers. So these young women might have been taken to visit somebody that had just given birth, and they're picking up the conversation around them. Obviously, picking up on animals and how animals give birth. But then also, I think just an element of curiosity and general conversation. So you've got these kind of layers of knowledge being built up that you wouldn't know about. There's no way of accessing these. These are oral knowledge structures. Nobody's going to write this down until you have an infanticide case. And then it suddenly turns up for us in the historical record in a way that we can't access any other way. So infanticide cases were a really rich source for me, particularly about community networks, because the people that are giving evidence then are tied in. These are the people that went to the birthing chamber. These are the people that expect to have access to the birthing chamber and perhaps are denied. And so you can start to see, it makes visible these networks that I'm not sure I could access any other way, actually. So that was the kind of main function of them. They're incredible sources of information, incidental information, you know, even down to household linens. And the kind of what you should have in preparation for birth, those are visible in infanticide cases too. So they're really rich sources of information, really hard to read. So it's a really emotional experience working with them in the archives, but absolutely full of these really useful nuggets of information.
As we discussed a little bit earlier, you present feeling as an important part of the history of birthing. What precautions did you take as you considered how these 18th century women felt, and what was useful for your analysis, as well as what did you watch out for?
So all the way through, when I was trying to write about 18th century women's experiences of birthing, I kept in mind a Twitter conversation that I'd had. So quite early on in my PhD studies, I asked Twitter what it felt like to give birth. And I got lots and lots and lots of responses, and not one of them was the same. They were all so different. And, you know, there were people that were describing it as the worst pain they'd ever felt. They thought they were going to die. Had people saying it was intensely uncomfortable. And pretty much every kind of version of sensation in between. And I thought that was utterly fascinating, that right now I can ask a group of people how it felt to give birth, and they would all give me a different answer. And that then got me kind of thinking about how I apply ideas of feeling and sensation backwards in history, and how I can then make these conclusions, draw these conclusions about how these women felt. So I tried always to keep in mind that I couldn't possibly really know how they felt as they were giving birth. It's a really elusive thing to capture. That said, I do attempt to understand how people are feeling. So there is the example of a will in which the woman writing the will is pregnant with her first child, and it sets out all of her belongings and where she wants them to go should she die giving birth. And she's very explicit that it should she die giving birth. And that is an indication of how she felt about the pregnancy. She's, you know, there's a real fear that this was going to be, you know, the final thing at the end of your life. Because lots of women knew other women that had died giving birth. And so that has to have been a kind of really oppressive sensation about pregnancy. Some of the women I write about are quite effusive in their letters about how it feels. So I have some beautiful descriptions from Frances Irwin, where she talks about the sensations of having little tendrils in her body entwined around her heart or around her neck. And she's kind of talking about the way it feels when she realizes she's pregnant. She has several daughters, 5 daughters, I think. And so she's experienced at this. She recognizes the kind of feelings and the sensations of pregnancy, and she describes them to her friend. And you can recognize them. I recognized them. I thought, I know the feeling that she's talking about there. I know what that is. And that's a kind of really direct link. So sometimes it was easy. Sometimes these women were providing me with information about how they felt. But then it's also interesting to think about some of the physiological elements of feeling and sensation. Because as I've said at the beginning, that is partly what makes childbirth this really seductive topic to study, is the idea that it's this kind of all-encompassing bodily event. You can't stop it if it's happening to you. There's nothing you can do. It's going to happen. Your body will do it anyway. And that's the same for me as it was for these women that I'm writing about. And yet we felt it differently. So when I started thinking about the body and the way that the body influenced birthing, that's how I arrived at hormones. And there, you know, you have to be really careful, because hormones didn't exist for the women that I'm writing about, but they must have shaped the way the birthing body behaved. So modern scholarship talks about the release of oxytocin when you're giving birth, and about how that can stop if you're not in an environment that feels safe and secure. And I can apply that to both bodies, to modern bodies and to 18th century bodies. But I have to recognize that culturally, what makes those bodies feel safe and secure is different. So what made my 18th century women feel safe and secure is very different from what made me feel so safe and secure when I was giving birth. And so it's that kind of understanding that when you immediately recognize something, you must question it, because it's so culturally prescribed. It's so shaped by the experiences of people around us, by the buildings that we live in, by the kind of expectations that we have, that you have to be really careful. So every time I was writing about 18th century bodies, I remembered this Twitter conversation that I'd had, and I tried really hard to kind of center that in the way that I approached 18th century bodies. So understanding that we'd all been through a similar physiological experience, but that it felt totally different. And I mean, you can tell me, Hannah, whether I sort of successfully managed to get a grasp on how people felt when they were giving birth. It seemed really elusive, but I certainly did my best to kind of cover the range of emotions and of feelings that these women might have experienced.
No, I certainly thought you were very successful. That was one of my my favorite bits about reading this book was seeing that feeling and emotion. It's something that I don't think you see very often in this literature. Did anything surprise you as you were researching and writing this book?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, so what was I surprised by? I was surprised by a lot of it, but at the same time, it seemed familiar too, right? And again, I'm going back to this idea of why childbirth is so seductive, because it feels familiar. It can't be, but it feels really familiar. So I really loved finding out about the kind of emotions that surrounded birthing. And, you know, the longest chapter in the book is about the family of birth and the way that other family members felt when a birth happened. I was really pleased when I realized that the overriding emotion, the kind of emotion that drives the people that were there during the birth, was love. That if you had to categorize it, it was loving. And I was relieved about that, because I think I'd maybe steeled myself for something a little bit more sort of mercenary, I suppose, something a little more unfeeling. And yet when you start to unpick it, love was really central. So to the way that birth was handled. And there's this real expectation of love between parent and child as well. I was pleased to see it come through so strongly when I was going through the primary sources. I think I was surprised by the amount of community involvement, by what a social space it was. And I remember as I was kind of writing up my PhD, I think I still somehow had in my mind this idea that it was a private space, that the birthing chamber was private. And of course it wasn't. It reached outwards. Even though that moment of delivery, there was a restricted number of people there. It wasn't private in the slightest. It was central in the middle of this community. And it was kind of drawing on all these different threads of community that people experienced every day, you know, borrowing things, borrowing linens, people coming to help, people going to fetch, people eating together and drinking together and talking about other people that were going on. So I think, yeah, maybe that was the most surprising element of the research, was kind of And maybe it's not surprising to other people, but for me, that realization that it was this important associational space, and that it was important for men and women, that it was a kind of central spot in the community that kind of arose from nowhere and then vanished without a trace. And I, you know, just kind of got absorbed back into daily life. And I thought that was really special to be able to kind of study it briefly before it vanished again.
What do you hope readers will take away from this book?
There's lots of things that readers could take away from this book. And I think perhaps when I started writing it, I hadn't quite realised the extent to which some of the discussions around bodily autonomy, around the kind of control and oversight of women's bodies, were going to become quite as prescient as they have. And so I would like people to take away from the book a kind of person-centred approach, just to begin with. So by studying the people at the middle of these kind of ideas, these events, we get a different perspective from when we understand, you know, from when we study different types of literature like the medical literature. But I would also like it to kind of form the basis of perhaps some thoughts around how important birth is seen in society, and also how it can make certain elements in society fearful, how it's something to be controlled and overseen. And I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about the history of childbirth and the way that, you know, it links into other types of histories, histories of sexuality, history of, you know, birth control and contraception, histories of medicine and healthcare. So I would like readers to take away from this book that the 18th century was this really kind of important formative point in our culture, and that it really sort of shaped the way in which women's history developed. The way that women were in society was kind of fundamentally linked to their ability to reproduce. I feel like I'm waffling. Does that make sense?
No, that's great. Well, Sarah, thank you for being on New Books in Women's History and for this wonderful conversation about giving birth in 18th century England. It was a pleasure to get to speak with you about your work.
Thanks, Hannah, for inviting me.